Before we start our episode today, this is just a reminder. History Hack does have a Patreon account and all of your donations are gratefully appreciated. There's lots of perks on there, secret groups on Facebook. Do get involved. We would love to see more of you. Enjoy the episode today. Hello and welcome to History Hack. More specifically, welcome to Boaty Week. Woo! This was basically to torture Alina, and I think it worked. She's not here. But anyway, it's Saturday evening. We're very excited. It's a bit of a party vibe in town because Beth is going to be hosting this one with me. Hey, Beth.
Hi, Alex. How you doing?
Mummy Beth's there as well.
Yeah, she's here in the background enjoying all of the history.
You've been for an Indian, right?
Yeah, we have. It was wonderful.
How does it feel to go out for a meal?
Oh, it's the best feeling in the world. It really is. To have plans on a Saturday afternoon in the summer.
But did they actually do that thing where they, like, you get to the door and it's basically like the third degree just to get through the door of the restaurant? Like,
yeah, we got there and I'd rang and said half an hour before, I said, can we just pop in? They said, yeah, of course. And then we got there and was like, have you booked a table? No, because you told me it was fine.
Have you got the NHS app? No. Have you got a camera phone? And it's like, all right, hang on, I'll do it all. But you don't have to, like, jump down my throat.
A cough.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but we had a great time.
We're going to have a great time tonight as well because we have a very special guest. We have historian and author and Down the Pub regular, Mr. Chris Sams with us. And he's really nervous and he so shouldn't be because he's going to talk to us. We're going World War One boaty today, aren't we? That's why you're here, because you were like, I need to know about World War One boats.
Yeah.
And so do I, because specifically, in case you haven't noticed on Down the Pub, Chris, you're a little obsessed with the German Navy, aren't you?
Just a little bit, yeah, yeah.
Why?
I'm not... Sadly, it started with Wikipedia on an early shift. I was on the train at 4:30 in the morning, and you know, they come up with like articles you might be interested in, and the first one that popped up was on the Emden, and I thought, well, I don't know anything about that, so I read that, and then I read the follow-up articles on von Spee, then the Battle of the Falklands, Battle of Coronel, and then the centenary rolled around, and I just found myself writing about it, and then just obsessively reading quite a bit about it.
It's brilliant. I love it. Because basically, you're gonna talk to us today specifically about German cruiser warfare, aren't you? And like German imperialism. And what I love about this, Sophie's with you as well. Sophie is awesome and adorable, and she's wearing a tiara, and we're pleased to have her as well. She's here to hear what Daddy's got to say. I have done a book on this. Set the scene for us with the German Far East, because the Germans do have a diddy little empire in 1914, don't they? So what have the Navy got to do with it? And tell us about the setup.
Like you said, it's one of the common misconceptions. Again, thanks to Blackadder, the German Empire consisted in 1914 of a small sausage factory outside Lake Tanganyika, which they actually had a bit more than that. They were late to the party, though, seeing as they didn't become a country until a unified country until after the Franco-Prussian War in 1871. But before that, in 1861, they gained permission from China in the Treaty of Peking to allow Prussian and then later German ships into Chinese waters. The Germans weren't entirely happy just with this, because they had to rely on other nations' ports. So they were using Britain's Hong Kong concession, Nagasaki in Japan, and Shanghai for all the maintenance things. And basically, they wanted their own port. And in 1894, during the first Sino-Japanese War, Rear Admiral Paul Hoffman, who was in charge of the Ostasian Geschwader, or East Asian Squadron, was tasked with trying to find a permanent base for the Germans, for the German Navy over there, because they would basically be the ones that would be policing the area for them and representing Germany in any issues. And Hoffman really wanted to get Kaohsiung Bay. And in 1896, Hoffman was replaced by Rear Admiral Tirpitz, who everyone probably knows, will have heard about at some point. And before he became famous for his shipbuilding, he was in charge of the East Asian Squadron, and he too wanted to get out Shell Bay.
I'm just laughing because he's more important for the pig in the Imperial War Museum, which we can yes. see later, right?
Pig. I will come to Tirpitz the pig as well at some point.
Everyone loves him.
Everyone loves the Tirpitz.
He will have his moment in the sun, don't worry.
Briefly. Yeah, and so he also wanted Kaohsiung Bay, but in his final report he kind of a bit uncertain, so the Kaiser didn't really push for it. However, he was then later replaced by Admiral von Diedrich, who made it his mission that he was going to get Kaohsiung Bay. And the following year, on the 1st of November, the missionaries Franz Xavier Nies and Richard Reinhard Henley were murdered, the Chinese Big Sword Society. So von Diedrich landed Marines and took the area to police it and bring it back under order, then refused to leave. So, and as the Chinese sort of tried to protest, larger ships of the German Navy turned up the following month. That March, there was another Treaty of Peking, which was 6th of March, which conferred a 99-year lease on Tsingtao Bay. Basically, the Germans colonized and invested vast amounts of money into the city. They even built their own brewery there, which is where Tsingtao beer comes from. And it's the only beer from the Far East that is uses German purity law to make it. Not that German purity law, the beer one.
Only a pretty four standard things. Way to colonize somewhere, isn't it? Because you get this, this is where how the French try and make inroads into Morocco after the turn of the century. So the Germans aren't really acting any different to any other colonial power. But how do they, I mean, they must be pretty reliant on their navy to administer this.
Yeah, absolutely. The army have absolutely no input whatsoever. In fact, even the governor of Tsingtao is a naval officer. Mm-hmm. The German Empire then expands in the Far East, with especially after the American-Spanish War, because the Spanish find themselves bankrupted by the war and they needed to sell off, need to make money. The Kaiser rolled up and said, tell you what, we'll buy all these old islands you don't want. So they end up with like the Carolines, the Marianas.
Is that how they've got the random possessions in the Pacific as well? The Australians and New Zealanders go for in 14.
Yeah. Germany managed to get New Guinea from Britain, which upset Australians quite a bit, and Samoa, which again upsets the New Zealanders, which is why the in 1914 they get really quite aggressive to try and get them back as quickly as possible. But the German Navy is the East Asian Squadron becomes really important, because with all these islands scattered around the ocean, the only way to get around is by ship. So the Navy, and especially with the isolated Pacific Islands, because they don't have any German citizens living there. They're quite isolated. There's no economic value in them at all. It's just a flag. So having a German gunboat cruise by, wave the flag, fire the guns off and go, you belong to Germany, is quite important. Whenever there's anything, a major political change or war within the Asian sphere, the cruiser squadron rock up, especially in 1900 with the Boxer Rebellion. And the attack on the Taku forts, the German gunboat Ilz actually is awarded, not the crew, but the ship itself is awarded the Paula Merite. So it has the blue max emblazoned on the hull for its actions in fighting against the Chinese forts. Marines under Lieutenant Weniger go in to join Admiral Seymour's advance on Peking. And there's a painting of them marching under the naval flag, and it's called Get Behind the Germans. Because they led it. And then again, even in the Russo-Japanese War of 1905, on 13th of August, the battleship Tsarevich with several destroyers had escaped the Battle of the Yellow Sea and interned in Tsingtao. And they coaled up from a British ship and attempted to leave. And the German squadron had to, the Hansa and the Fürst Bismarck, actually blockade them in to stop them from escaping. They're also responsible for policing any rebellions. There was Soki's Rebellion. Basically, the German overseers were being imperial as they are, beating the natives and refusing to give them rights. So a German overseer was murdered and everyone ran to the hills. So the German Navy rocked up and blasted them to hell, which is pretty standard. But it was like several gunboats and a light cruiser. So they are really important to administering and policing the area. And the squadron itself is divided up. By 1914, it's divided. You have the Australian station, which should consist of two very elderly gunboats, one of which has already been sent back to Germany and they're waiting her replacement, which is the Guerre. She's coming from Africa. And the Cormoran, which is laid up in Tsingtao Harbour with a dodgy engine. You have the Emden, which is a light cruiser. She's at Tsingtao. The other light cruiser, Leipzig, is off the coast of Mexico for the Mexican Civil War. Representing German needs. She's just relieved the Nuremberg, which is on her way back. And then there's the centerpiece of the squadron, which is the two armored cruisers, Scharnhorst and Gneisenau. And Scharnhorst is the flagship of Grand Admiral, Vice Admiral Maximilian von Spee, who is ultimately in charge of the entire area for the fleet.
So before we get to the war, tell us about von Spee, because you love this man.
Yeah.
I just put this in your notes. So go on, you can have like 30 seconds to a minute to tell us why you love this guy.
Well, he's faced with a massive dilemma, and he is alone. He hasn't got the ability. Berlin basically gives him a free hand and said, look, whatever you think is right, do it. And although he comes across, he listens to all his officers and makes decisions based on what they say, he also suffers from anxiety from the big decisions as well. So he finds himself saying, okay, this is what we're going to do, and then quietly panicking about it. He doesn't smoke to excess. He doesn't drink to excess. He does enjoy a game of bridge. But he's committed to doing this one course of action whilst trying to uphold the honor of a German officer and not turning to basically piracy. But I'll come to that in a bit with his war plan. And I just think he had a rather unfortunate end. However, very noble. He also lost his two sons in the process as well.
So he has a bit of a dilemma, doesn't he, of in these early stages of the First World War, of what he does with his forces, von Spee. Does he go west? Does he go east? Does he cause chaos in the islands, which I think is the most appropriate course of action, always cause chaos wherever you can. what does he go for? What does von Spee end up doing?
Your version of chaos, though, is just go and drink all the wine and get a bit shouty. I think he's like shedding and stuff.
It's good chaos.
I think a lot of the crew would have gone for that. But for von Spee, it was a lot harder because he had several choices on his plate. As you said, he could go east. There was a drive for them to go east, to head for Germany, East Africa, head out into the Indian Ocean, cause as much chaos as possible on English shipping, because they knew that the English and the Australian fleets would be heading down to fight, take the German colonies. So if they had scooted out towards the Indian Ocean, they could cause some real damage without seeing any Allied ships. However, von Spee pointed out that the amount of coal that his armoured cruisers would need to continue going, they probably wouldn't encounter that many ships. Von Müller, of the captain of the Emden, says that we should just cruise around and do as much damage as possible around the colonies. But again, he says the Australians have the battle cruiser Australia, which can take out his fleet on its own. Its armor is too thick. It's got battleship sized guns. It's faster than his ships. And if they run into Australia, the battle's over. The fleet is reliant on its ability to get coal, ammunition, and stay and get repaired where it can. But von Spee knows that the minute the war starts, Tsingtao is going to be blockaded. And it's only a matter of time before the colonies go as well. But Tsingtao is where he's got his ammunition, his coal supplies, and a dry dock where he can have his ships fixed. So the only real option open to him that he can see is to head west. He's been told by Berlin that Chile and the South American republics are quasi-friendly to Germany and that they could be able to get coal from there. But von Spee then decides as well that maybe it's time to try and attempt a home run and head back for Germany. It's his duty to return his men and his ships to the German flag because there'll be more needed in the North Sea.
Okay, so you've mentioned that Berlin basically trusted their man and said, you're the scrappy little underdog, do what you got to do. But the British don't do that, do they?
Well, Churchill, he sees the naval war as a giant game of chess. And he solely can control all the pieces on the board. He doesn't trust his local commanders or even the ship's captains. And will send out lengthy orders and instructions, like he did in the Mediterranean with the chase for Goeben and Breslau.
It's almost like you're saying he's got a massive ego.
Yeah, that'd be fair.
ego, surely not.
But then at the same time, he, in a way, I'm going to throw him a bone, this one time throw him a bone and say that he can actually see the bigger picture, whereas Admiral Jerram in Hong Kong can only see his forces. Admiral Patey of the Australian fleet can only see his forces, whereas, to be fair to Churchill and von Battenberg, they have got the map in front of them and they can see where all the squadrons are and what they're doing. So he's trying to coordinate a bigger effort. And because it's such a large expanse, the Germans could just slip through gaps. And basically, Admiral Jerram in Hong Kong comes up with a plan of immediately moving out of Hong Kong and blockading Tsingtao. But as soon as he leaves, Churchill orders him back. Admiral Patey thinks we're going to move up and attack. There are several ports in New Guinea. We'll attack those because that's where the Germans could be hiding. He goes to leave, gets pulled back by the Australian Admiralty because they fear that the Germans are going to attack Australia, which gives von Spee time. Jerome then leaves again and goes to radio silence so that he doesn't have to listen to Churchill. They go and take out the wireless tower of on Yap Island, which the Germans have a wireless network across the world, which can control and direct all their ships. So the British thinking is if we can take out those wireless stations as quick as possible, then the German Berlin can't direct them. But von Spee is working on the theory as well. The wireless is all well and good for communicating. But if you send a wireless message, people can triangulate where you are and where that message is coming from. So for the Germans, they try not to use wireless because it'll just give away their position all the time. Mm. And so, yeah, Churchill, Jerome and Patey keep finding their hands being tied, even to the point that Patey's squadrons get pulled away to support the New Zealand invasion of Samoa, in which they then had to wait 10 days for the troop ships to turn up. And then once they've done that, they get pulled away to support the Australian invasion of New Guinea, which again buys von Spee time, and he keeps scootling across the Pacific.
You mentioned it briefly earlier, but you talked about the Emden and causing a bit of chaos around British colonial sites, like around Madras and places like that. But why is it a name that we all know so much? Why is it synonymous with those pesky Germans?
Well, the Emden's quite. That's quite a glittering career. She captures 20 Allied merchant ships and sinks two warships on her own. Von Müller, von Spee did see the logic in von Müller's plan and actually released Emden as well as the Hilton cruisers Cormoran and Prince Eitel Friedrich to cause chaos in the area. And Emden immediately cruised towards the Indian Ocean and along the Indian coast. They erected a fake funnel, so she looked like HMS Yarmouth, possibly the greatest scam in history, which I'll be coming to next week.
sneak peek.
Yeah. And they the behaviour of the German crew was considered exemplary by the British crews that they captured. They were all treated well. They were all put. The Germans used to have. Keep one ship as what the first officer von Mucker called a prison ship or junker, and where they just put all the prisoners on it. And when it got to a certain level, they would release it to a neutral or friendly port. And because the British prisoners had always been treated so well, on each occasion that these ships were released, they always greeted the gave three cheers for the German crew and the captain. They did. Do a couple of really ballsy moves. They did indeed sail into Madras Harbour, where British officers were celebrating the sinking of the Emden, which is they'd received news. They were all in the club drinking and having a good time as Emden opened fire on the Burma oil drums and then the ships in the harbour, but did not fire a single shell at civilian targets. And once it had done enough damage, she sailed out. It caused a panic and a good chunk of the population fled. Even the governor fled. He didn't return for 3 days. And then it caused a panic. They had to close down all the shipping in the area. And the Royal Navy had to stand there with egg on its face going, well, we don't know where it is. Emden then went off to the Chagos Islands, which were British, and then told them that they didn't know there was a war. So they actually used the British to help repair the ship and clean it before sailing into Padang Harbour, again disguised as HMS Yarmouth, where there was loads of merchant ships sat. And the Russian cruiser Zemchug, which they then promptly sank with a torpedo. The Fox had really got into the hen house, firing off shells left, right and centre, starts chasing what they think is a torpedo boat. It's a government launch. When they realise that the whole situation is getting too hot, Emden pulls out of the harbour, stops one British ship, puts the crews into lifeboats, and the captain hands a letter to the British captain, say, apologising for chasing a government launch because they thought it was a warship, and also apologising for not stopping to pick up Russian sailors in the water because, in his words, it was too dangerous for the German crew, and also we figured there were enough Allied ships around that they could pick them up. They then get attacked by a French destroyer, which they sink, bring the wounded on board, treat them, and then capture another British ship, but instead of sinking it, they put the wounded onto it and just direct it towards a nearby Dutch island, where they had a field hospital to treat the wounded. So their behaviour was seen. It's kind of like Rommel in the Second World War, where you need the, obviously in the Western on the Western Front, you have the beastly Hun in Belgium. You needed a kind of a good German to say, well, actually, the chivalric behaviour is actually going on, and this is a good enemy that we're fighting, rather than all dastardly Hun.
And in this area, there's a lot of interaction, I suppose you could say, with like the Australians and the New Zealanders, isn't there? Because despite what certain parts of the First World War area would like you to think, the Australian and New Zealanders didn't have their first interactions at Gallipoli, did they?
Well, yeah. The Australians, as I said, the New Zealanders land Samoa. Pretty much unopposed. The Germans on the island say we shall fight to the last bullet, but within a couple of hours, not one bullet's been fired, and the New Zealanders just march up, find the wireless tower in near Apia, where the engineers are trying to disable it, and they just cart them off and have it fixed by the next day. At New Guinea, it's a bit more of a struggle. The Germans fall back into the jungle and dig trenches, have snipers up trees, and the Australian army and naval troops have a bit of a ruck with them, including with snipers picking officers off. One of the Australian officers thinks it's a good idea to try and rally the troops by standing up and waving a sword saying, "Follow me, chums," and gets shot through the head. But eventually they capture a German officer and convince him at gunpoint to come with them. As one of the reporters put it, strolling up through the jungle as if on a Sunday afternoon looking at flora, and get the German officer to, every time they get near some trees, to yell to get the snipers out to surrender. And they catch the German, what's left of the German garrison in that area, having lunch by the wireless station, and at gunpoint, and take it. And then there's another battle at Bitapaka, which again is brought down by the Australian HMAS encounter. But the German Navy roll up there as well, because one of the auxiliaries, the Cormoran, which had been a Russian ship that Emden caught in the first few days, was hiding, waiting for another ship for the Prince Seidel Friedrich, when the Australian Navy turned up, and it was hidden in a grove with loads of foliage around it as the Australian Navy went past. And the captain had this great idea of, well, we'll wait until they've all gone, and then I will land my crew and we will try and take the Australian encampment while they're all sleeping. And then they were told, local intelligence came back, said, no, it's a lot bigger than your crew and you will get caught. And then they heard on the wireless that the battlecruiser Australia was in the area, and they decided to quit the area as well.
I love this. I love that they're just dastardly. I love it. If I wasn't British and they were German, then I would be like, yes, it's brilliant. But I love this as well. It sounds like the dream war, because then he decides he's going to go to Tahiti. Like, who wouldn't? If they had a boat of their own and they're in the Pacific, who wouldn't be like, oh yeah, I feel a mission coming on in Tahiti, and maybe several weeks, and there may be rum involved.
And lying on beaches.
Yeah.
Yeah. Strategic importance to Tahiti.
Yeah, well, they get the towels out first. Lying down on a towel.
Well, before that though, they have this, von Spee has this, that he sends off Nuremberg to get information, because he's slowly creeping from lagoon to lagoon, resupplying as they go. And they get news from Hawaii that Samoa has fallen. So he tasks Nuremberg to keep taking it going across the Pacific, whilst he turns himself and Eisenhower round, and they go hurtling back to Apia, which takes 5 days. It's about 1,000 miles in the wrong direction, in the hope that they're going to catch the Allied fleet at anchor and sink the Australia. Where it's to, but when they get there, they find there's no one there, except for a lot of very upset New Zealand troops who are all wearing woolen uniforms and sweating.
I just say, if I was in Hawaii, I'd be like, no, we blatantly won't make it on time. We should just stay here.
Yeah. Well, one of the cruisers does, but so Scharnhorst and Eisenhower head to Apia, and all the New Zealanders think, oh god, in a minute there's going to be boatloads of angry German marines coming ashore, and under those guns we've got nothing that can stop them. But von Spee thinks, well, even if we do take this island, there is we can't hold it. So they just cruise off, and they decide that with coal shortages, they try and attack Tahiti to get fresh coal. And so in the early hours of the morning, Scharnhorst and Neisenau enter the harbour and sink the gunboat Zelli, which the first officer of Neisenau describes as saying that how impudent the French were by firing at us with their pea shooters, because they only had really tiny guns. And the rest of the guns, the French lieutenant who was in charge of Zelli had taken charge of the island and put some of the guns up on the hill to fire down on them. And it even set up armored cars, sort of rudimentary armored cars in case there was an invasion. But they also set fire to the coal reserve. So von Spee had to bite his tongue, turn around and fly, sail off. But that was after they'd wasted ammunition that they'd never get back. And so they sailed on to Easter Island.
Another my bucket list destination as well. Why does he decide to go to Tahiti?
It was mainly for the coal. They figured that because the French fleet in the area wasn't too big. It was the cruisers Duplay and Montcalm, and they were back with serving at the Battle of Tsingtao and looking for him and his ships in New Guinea and all the islands. So they thought it would be worth a gamble if they could get in, hit hard, take as much coal as they could, and get out. It would help them along their way, especially that early in the journey they had been hit by a tropical storm, and to maximise the amount of coal they could carry, they had coal and livestock on the decks. And of course, a tropical storm washes that all away. They lost loads of food, cows, pigs, and more importantly, mountains of coal. So they desperately needed it. Which they luckily get when they, well, I say luckily, when they get to Easter Island, they encounter the cruiser Leipzig, which and Dresden. And Leipzig brings four ships from the Amasis line laden with coal to resupply the squadron.
So you just mentioned the Leipzig there. And the Leipzig does get up to some quite interesting exploits, don't they? The causes a bit of a scare, doesn't it, on the West Coast with America and Canada, and kind of throws a bit of a spanner in the works. What kind of happens there? It's to do with trade, isn't it?
Well, yeah, absolutely. She doesn't actually fire a shot. And as a raider, she has compared to Emden and the Karlsruhe, which is off Brazil, she has a really, really lame career. But for the Canadians, they think she's a full-blown invasion threat. Because they don't know where the Nuremberg is. And so they think Leipzig is cruising around with Nuremberg. And also on the west coast of Mexico, the only two British warships are two sloops, which are tiny, the Algerine and Shearwater. And as soon as war's looming, Churchill says, you need to get the hell out of there, because if Leipzig comes to you, you're doomed. And so Leipzig starts to chase them as soon as war starts. And the Canadians have only got a very old cruiser, the HMCS Rainbow, which is basically decommissioned in the training ship. And she puts to sea just before war is declared. And she hasn't even got any real shells. She's got practice shells filled with gunpowder. If she gets into conflict with Leipzig, she's going to sink. And if there's Leipzig and Nuremberg, then she's really in trouble. And even the captain says that the only weapon I've got of any decent stock is my wireless set, so I can say Leipzig's here. Canada puts out a request for reinforcements, but the only squadron in the area is Jeremoff Hong Kong, and he's loath to send any ships until Churchill overrules him and sends HMS Newcastle. But Leipzig just casually cruises up the coast to San Francisco as Rainbow goes hurtling around up and down, looking for her and the sloops, and they just miss each other at San Francisco. But just the mere threat of Leipzig being in the area means that no British flag ships are leaving. So there's loads of supply stocks of food, salmon, pelts, wood, and it's just not traveling anywhere, which has a massive economic effect across the Canadian American border. And then when Rainbow does go out, and they think that they are going to see Leipzig, they clear the ship of all flammable kit. That's washed ashore off San Francisco. And they keep finding bits of wood with Rainbow on it. And they think that the Germans have actually sunk her. But they managed to miss each other. Rainbow goes back up north, finds the Newcastle. But again, there's another invasion scare that some civilians had seen Nuremberg and Leipzig off Prince Rupert Island. And so Rainbow has to go looking for them. The captain of the Newcastle then takes, as a senior naval officer, takes over building defences. which the Canadian government don't like because it's costing them money. So they actually send a rear admiral out to take over. So they've got the senior officer and they can say, stop spending our money. And then a Japanese cruiser, the Izumo, turns up and they do a proper sweep south looking for Leipzig. But Leipzig's already quit the area because there's no one leaving port. And cruises back down to Mexico, where they catch one British ship, and her captain, Captain Hahn, decides that the best course of action is to get off the trade route for a bit. So he goes to the Galapagos Islands. Basically, these Germans go around looking at tourist destinations, and they wait there for a couple of weeks.
Sounds like the best war ever. Leg it to another holiday destination and have some cocktails. That's basically what's going on here, isn't it?
I mean, that's what my priorities would be if I was on, if I was in a war. I definitely wouldn't be in the trenches of the Western Front.
No. But well, yeah, after
a genius, isn't he, Chris?
Yeah, it tries to be. The Captain Hahn then goes back to the trade spy and manages to capture one more ship before he gets a wireless transmission from the Dresden, which has come hurtling down the coast of South America on the west side, the east side. And said her orders are to join up with Leipzig and to cooperate together until they realise that this cruiser squadron's on its way, and then they're both ordered to the to Easter Island to join von Spee with as many supply ships as they can get. And suddenly von Spee's plan for making a home run is back on, because he has a lot more coal than he knows what to do with, and they start planning the next phase.
Why does, I'll bring Churchill in now, he decides that the Canopus is going to be the answer to his problems. Why is that?
Well, the only British squadron in the area is Kit Craddock's North American squadron, which is actually now operating from New York all the way down to the Falkland. Craddock has this belief that if he can have enough ships, he can catch von Spee. But at the time, he only has two old armored cruisers, the Monmouth and the Good Hope, which are mostly crewed by reservists. And the secondary armament is in casemates. And if it's rough weather, they can't fire because the waves are in the way. And he has the light cruiser Glasgow, which becomes really important, and the auxiliary light, which is just a liner, the Otranto, which is fitted out with guns. And he is pleading with Churchill that he needs more ships, and that he even comes up with ideas to get the Exeter Relief HMS Cornwall, send her down, and he wants the new armoured cruiser Defence to come and join his forces. But Churchill's convinced that the Canopus, which is an elderly pre-dreadnought, will be the answer, because he keeps referring to it as the citadel around which Craddock could build his forces. Mm. But she's old. I mean, not that old, but old enough that she was going to be scrapped.
No one's got their best ships in this area, have they? The best ships in Europe.
Canopus was in British waters. She was mobilised in 1914, and she'd helped with the convoys across from England to France. And then she, basically what Churchill's doing, so he can keep his dreadnoughts in the North Sea to combat the Germans, he's releasing his pre-dreadnoughts to areas that to act as a citadel. So the Triumph was reactivated in Hong Kong, Swiftsure off India, and Goliath is sent out to Africa, and Canopus is sent out to hunt down to help hunt the German squadron, just for her sheer firepower and armor. But she can only do 12 knots, so she will slow down the entire squadron. It's something like 12 miles an hour, roughly. And she will slow down the whole of Craddock's squadron. And so Craddock keeps arguing, why can't I just leave her at the Falkland Islands? Or she can come up behind us escorting my supply ships, and I'll just go ahead with the armoured cruisers.
Just for Churchill, people that don't know, this is because a squadron only ever travels as fast as its slowest ship, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's also been argued that Canopus, if she did run into the German squadron, wouldn't be much good anyway. But that's sort of with hindsight. But for Churchill, the Canopus was the answer. And he was trying to get, because Churchill was worried that if Craddock went round looking for von Spee and von Spee slipped behind him, if the Germans got to the Falkland Islands and burnt and destroyed the coaling station there, and then sailed north quickly enough and got to the Alboros Rocks and took them out, then the British fleet wouldn't have anywhere to coal south of New York.
or even the Caribbean. Churchill was trying to draw a second line of defence off the River Plate under Vice Admiral Stoddart. So if von Spee did get past Cradock, he'd be caught there. They were also trying to build up a force off Cape Town in case von Spee carried on heading that way towards the Cape of Good Hope. And Australia, the Izumo and the Newcastle were coming down from North America to covering Panama in case von Spee doubled back that way. So he's slowly being caught in a trap, but they didn't realise that at that point. And so Cradock goes around Cape Horn with his forces, with Canopus trudging along behind with the supply ships until they get to Coronel. And the Glasgow gets a report that there's German shipping in the area. At the same time, von Spee gets a report that Glasgow's in the area. And so the German squadron starts moving south and transmitting Leipzig's wireless signal of LE as if Leipzig is patrolling to try and lure the Glasgow onto them. But they get a surprise because they get Cradock's whole squadron, who is just a surprise because they just think they're finding Leipzig.
So I'm guessing with what comes next, is this von Spee's finest hour? Is it, do you think? Obviously you do as a German noble. but subjectively, is it his finest hour?
I think so. I mean, it's the first time the Royal Navy has been beaten at sea. The whole fleet has been beaten since the Napoleonic Wars. And it's a shock because it's not just beaten a little bit. It's routed. The Germans stick to the coast, which means as they come down to the south with the British out to sea. And although von Spee's in the dicey position that the sun, his gunners are firing into the sun, so they can't really see, they just have to play for time. Because as the sun sets, the British ships become silhouetted against the sun, so they can see them. Whereas the German ships are, you can't pick them out because they're a dark mass against the dark mass of the coastline. And the German, the Ostasian Geschwader had been, had won the Kaiser's shooting cup 2 years running. They were expert gunners. And the orders were that the Scharnhorst would concentrate on Good Hope. Gneisenau would concentrate on Monmouth. And at that point, there was only Dresden and Leipzig. They'd concentrate on Glasgow and the Otranto. Cradock orders the Otranto to get out of there because she's an ocean. She's got no armor. She can't stand this fire. She's so the two light cruisers. Right? Just with some extra guns strapped on.
Yeah, so she's just that's just the scenario whereby the government have paid towards building her so that they can call her up for service in the event of a war. Guns on her and sent her to war.
Yeah, both England and Germany did it. Lots of German liners had mounting positions on them, and the cruisers in the Caribbean, Dresden and Karlsruhe, had extra guns on the aboard so that they could arm any merchant ships or liners that they came across. And the Karlsruhe armed the Crown Prince Wilhelm, which is basically the German version of the Titanic.
Yeah, and then we didn't get the Lusitania, did we? Because they said the coal consumption was ridiculous, so that it would be detrimental to the war.
Oh, absolutely, and that's what happened to Crown Prince Wilhelm as well. She was just the sheer amount of coal that she was consuming. They had trouble sustaining themselves even in cruiser warfare. The Cormoran, which got left behind in the Pacific, had a similar thing, and she had to intern herself at Guam because they just ran out of coal. I think they turned up with only a few kilos of coal and coconut husks, which is all that they could find to burn. And the Prince Eitel Friedrich abandoned the Pacific and chased after the cruiser squadron because they'd managed to find enough coal. But yeah, the liners were just not suited to the war that they thought they might be useful for.
But Coronel, how bad is it for the Royal Navy?
It's awful. Going back to the Mediterranean, Admiral Trowbridge, who'd been in charge of the first cruiser squadron, had misinterpreted. Churchill had given very vague orders not to engage a superior force. Well, what Churchill meant was don't engage the Austrian fleet if it comes south.
Yeah.
But as the battle cruiser Goeben went hurling past, Trowbridge and his first officer, Captain Ray, Fawcett Ray, considered that a battle cruiser was superior to his entire force because it was faster than them, it had longer range than them, so it could just keep sailing in circles and sink his entire fleet. So Trowbridge didn't engage. Trowbridge gets sacked, as does his superior, Admiral Berkeley Milne. Trowbridge was a friend of Craddock. So Craddock has this concern that if he doesn't engage, he too will get sacked. I mean, Trowbridge is going to be put up for court-martial. And so Craddock doesn't want that dishonour. In fact, before leaving the Falkland Islands, he said to, he left a letter for a colleague that basically blamed Churchill for his death and had buried all his medals in the governor's garden because he knew that he would have to engage, and which is what he then does following the sort of the Nelson tactic of move closer, keep fire. So he's trying, he turns Monmouth and Good Hope to charge at the Germans. But the Germans just keep, their accuracy is so good that they knock out the forward turrets on both, both armored cruisers. And then Good Hope explodes, taking the entire crew down with it. Of course, the Germans can't, because it's getting dark, they couldn't stop to pick up survivors even if they wanted to. And there's a heavy swell. So the lifeboats were no good whatsoever. Monmouth starts to sink. Dresden and Leipzig, Glasgow stops firing because every time they fire, the muzzle flashes are betraying their position. And so Dresden and Leipzig are sent to go and look for British shipping. The Dresden is cruising along and it sees a cruiser coming towards it. So they go into an attack run to launch torpedoes. The Leipzig also sees a cruiser coming towards them, goes to attack run to launch torpedoes. And at the last minute, they realize that one of them's Leipzig, one of them's the Dresden. And so they pull off and not sink each other. The Glasgow finds Monmouth sinking and signals them, what can we do? And the Monmouth says pretty much nothing. We're going to try and get out as best we can. And Glasgow, Captain Luce has to make the tough decision to leave the armored cruiser because there's literally nothing they can do. And then the Nuremberg turns up because she'd been off stopping Allied shipping. It turns up late to the battle, comes across the Monmouth and tries to signal her to get her to surrender, but gets no response. The Union Jack is still flying. And one of the rules is if the ship is flying its flag, it's still a combatant.
Right.
And this will haunt the East Asian Squadron later. But Nuremberg, again, flashes for surrender. Monmouth turns to face her, so they feel that they're going to come under fire. So von Schönberg, the captain, orders two torpedoes to be put into her, and she rolls over and goes down again with all hands. And so the only survivors are the Glasgow, the Otranto, and they flee back to the Canopus and then back to the Falkland Islands. For the British, it's a horrifying loss. For the Germans, they roll into Valparaiso Harbour, where they're greeted as heroes. The German population there go absolutely mental. They get loads of reservists offering to join the German crew. And a lady comes and gives von Speyer a large bunch of flowers. And he looks at them and he says, they're very beautiful. They look great on my grave. Because he's now convinced that he's sunk a British fleet. He knows that the British will not get home at all.
Well. Yeah, let's go. Let's move on to that because it is really quite a sad end for this squadron, isn't it? So basically, Fisher goes, kill them! And he runs like he would, like he says, because he knows they're after him. What happens next?
Well, Von Speyer takes his time. If he had left, because they gather as many supplies as they could, and then they stop for 5 days St. Quentin Bay to recoal and resupply again, and this gives the British time to react. And Vice Admiral Sturdee comes hurtling south with the Invincible and Inflexible and collects Stoddart's fleet and heads towards the Falkland Islands, where Canopus has now beached herself into as an island fortress and started putting guns around the island as well.
So Invincible and Inflexible are big ass battle cruisers, right?
Yeah,
it's like Daddy's home now. Mm.
Yeah, they're basically they have the speed of a cruiser, but the armory of a battleship. They're designed to take down armored cruisers, which is what von Spee's two main ships are. And so von Spee stops, resupplies. Critically, they have two missed messages. A German agent in Uruguay finds out that there's battle cruisers heading south. Doesn't pass it on. The cruiser squadron go around the Cape Horn, get caught in another storm, lose loads of coal. Leipzig and Dresden and Nuremberg almost capsize because of the strength of the storm and the fact that their decks are covered with coal. So the Germans have to, the crew are on deck shoveling coal overboard to stop the ships from sinking. They then, as they pass through the Horn, there is a German national, Alfred Pagels, who is a fisherman, an ex-German sailor, hears that there's battle cruisers in the area, and he takes his boat out in the storm to go and find the German cruiser squadron, but fatally doesn't see them to pass on the message. And so they keep going. And so Von Spee comes up with this great idea to avenge Samoa and to get coal, knowing that the only place that they can go is the Falkland Islands. Mm-hmm. So he orders the plan is that the Gneisenau and the Nuremberg will approach the Falkland Islands, dominate the harbour, sink any British ships that they find, because they're not expecting much there, arrest the governor as a prisoner, and take him back to Germany and take as much coal as they can possibly get.
Or is it stupid? Or a bit of both?
If they hadn't have if they'd have left and gone straight away, it would have been a really ballsy move. Mm. I don't think they were expecting the British to react as quickly as they did. And I think they're kind of driven by desperation as well, because they've heard reports from Berlin that they will get some resupply ships for them off Uruguay and up the Brazilian coast. But they can't guarantee that they're going to get them. But if they can have an armed landing like they did at Tahiti, they could indeed get as much coal as they could, and also deny that position to the British as well. So it is kind of a ballsy move. It just doesn't play out that way. And in fact, when as Gneisenau and Nuremberg approach the island, they see tripod masts in the harbour, and they think it's an old Queen class battleship. Then Canopus opens fire and hits the funnel of the Gneisenau. Great plumes of water appearing around them, and Captain Maker decides it's time to withdraw. He signals Von Spee and he said, "Yeah, let's just get the hell out of here." So they try to pull away and faint as if they're heading back around the Horn, but they're actually going to head off, regroup, and then head north again. But the Canopus signals Sturdy, because the tripod masts are actually the two battle cruisers. They'd also seen, because the British had only arrived the day before, they were coaling, so there's large amounts of dust going up in the air. And so the Germans think that the British are also burning the coal supplies like they did at Tahiti. Sturdy casually orders the fleet to get up steam and leave port, and then goes and has breakfast. And then they begin the chase.
So, Chris, do you want to just then tell us how this plays out for the Germans and for the British as well?
For Von Spee, they because they think it's an old Queen class battleship, they think, you know, we get up enough steam, we'll keep going. But the battle cruisers obviously faster than them. And so the German fleet is strung out with Scharnhorst and Gneisenau leading, then the Dresden, Nuremberg, and the Leipzig bringing up the rear, and the resupply ships heading off. I think they were heading to Pitcairn Island, and they would go and join them later. But it becomes obvious that the British are gaining. But the battle cruisers are going so fast that the whole ships are vibrating, which makes the first salvos miss, because they can't calibrate the guns for it. Also, because of the amount of smoke they're generating, Sturdy has to redeploy the fleet so that the smoke of the lead ships aren't blocking the guns, the views of the gunners of the other ships. Leipzig comes under fire. So Von Spee decides that there's only one thing, because Leipzig, she won't last. So Von Spee decides that the best course of action is for Scharnhorst and Gneisenau to buy time for the light cruisers with the lives of his men. So he turns Scharnhorst and Gneisenau round and tells the light cruisers to scatter, which they then attempt to do. So Scharnhorst and Gneisenau form the joyous naval term of cross the T, which they go vertically to the British horizontal so they can bring more guns to bear, and start firing off ripple salvos sort of from front to back. Apparently, the British said that the German gunnery was absolutely beautiful, and it was precise. It just didn't do any damage, no real damage. And then the British start firing with the Lidar, 12-inch lyddite shells, and one of the descriptions was that they would go out puncturing the German ships as if they were made of fine bone china, and it just becomes a massacre. At one point, the Vice Admiral's pennant is ripped away from Scharnhorst. Mayerker signals Scharnhorst, because he's worried about his friend. Him and von Spee have worked together quite for many years, signals and says, is the Admiral right? And he gets a response of, yeah, I'm doing fine. I think you might have been right that attacking the Falklands was a bad idea. And then... Because beforehand there'd been a conference between the captains and the admiral, and you'd asked their opinions, and Mayerker said, "No, this is not a good idea," and I've been overruled. But Scharnhorst then turns signals and says, "You try and make as much steam as you possibly can." And Scharnhorst turns to single-handedly charge the two British battle cruisers, and it went as well as you'd expect. They could see fires through the holes in the ship. But she carried on firing, and even when the water was up to the fore turret, she was still firing her guns. And then there was a rumble, and then the ship just went up straight down with her propellers still going. No survivors. The British carried on. Knysnau wasn't going anywhere. She was just as damaged. Even the first aid hospital had been destroyed on board. The fleet padre is killed. The crew are in an awful state. And so Mayerker decides that there's nothing he can do and orders the crew to abandon ship, and they scuttle her. And what the survivors that do go into the water then start dying of shock because the water's freezing. Others get attacked by albatrosses, which I didn't know was a thing at first. But yeah, it was apparently quite savage. They were like pecking at eyes and stuff. It's really quite horrible.
They're massive as well, aren't they?
Yeah. They really razor-sharp bills, and they just started ripping the wounded men to pieces. But they do get picked up. They do pick up survivors. The rest of the squadron, the supply ships, a couple of civilians on one of the islands see the supply ships go past and send a signal to Sturdy saying that they think the Germans are landing Marines behind their back. So HMS Bristol and the liner Macedonia go and intercept them, sink them, take them all prisoner. Leipzig, the British then divide the lighter ships to chase the light cruisers, with the armored cruiser Kent chasing the Nuremberg and the armored cruiser Cornwall chasing Leipzig, and the Glasgow is going to chase the Dresden. Dresden manages to get a hit on Glasgow, which slows her down. So Glasgow, realizing she's never going to catch Dresden, joins the Cornwall in sinking the Leipzig. Leipzig puts up a fight. In fact, she stays afloat longer than Nuremberg. But there is one of those awful tragedies of war where the Leipzig is on fire. She's not going anywhere. They've tried torpedo runs. That's not going anywhere. The guns have all fallen silent. So the captain orders his men all on deck, and he's going to order abandon ship. Glasgow signals and says, "We don't want to, you must surrender." And then something exploded on the deck of Leipzig. The British think they're under fire, and so they rake the decks where all the crew were all stood ready to abandon ship. So about 100 men get ripped to shreds. The British then signal that still think that they're a combatant because the flag's still flying, but there's a raging inferno at the bottom of the flagpole, so no one can get to it. One crewman goes to try and rip it down, gets burnt alive. And so the few handful of survivors that are still alive on Leipzig go and take shelter on the forecastle. Eventually they manage to fire off green flares to try and signal surrender, and Glasgow signals that they're going to lower boats to try and save them. And the captain hands out the last of his cigarettes to the crew and say, "Good luck." And he walks back onto the bridge as the ship disappears under the waves. Most of the men that did get off died in the water, because it's 9 o'clock now, it's getting dark. And the only real survivors were the officers. And that was only because they had whistles and were able to, bring attention to where they were in water. Nuremberg's chased by Kent. Kent almost blows up. You get the exploding battle cruisers at Jutland. Kent had the same problem. She gets hit by a shell, which sets fire to some cordite charges in one of the casements, which then starts a fire going down into the shaft below. And if it had carried on to the magazine, Kent would have exploded. But one of the Marine sergeants on duty sees the fire, douses the ready ammunition in water and shuts the door. And he only gets the military cross for it, or the military medal for it. I forget which one off the top of my head. But ultimately, he saved the Kent from destruction. Kent being an armored cruiser, they managed to stoke her up to above her her commissioning speed. She's doing a lot faster than anyone thought she'd ever be able to do. And she catches up with Nuremberg and just takes her apart. Her commander later feels guilty about this and writes that he hopes that he wasn't overzealous and caused unnecessary casualties aboard. Nuremberg also comes to a stop. Her boilers explode because she was in dire need of a refit before the war started, and they're just not ready to take the kind of speed that she's needed. And so two boilers go out, and they try to lower wounded in a lifeboat. The lifeboat falls apart because it's been holed with shell holes, and the wounded all end up in the drink and die. And then Nuremberg itself capsizes, and I think it's only about five or six survivors from Nuremberg as well, and the rest of the crew were all killed. In the battle, not only did von Spee go down, but his two sons, his youngest son on the Neisse now and his oldest son on the Nuremberg.
I will never mock you again for your von Spee obsession. He's a badass, isn't he?
I'll make a note of that very quickly.
Yeah, like live fast, die sort of young is basically his mantra, isn't it?
I think if he got back to Germany, I think he was better than Scheer. I'm going to come out and say that. I think he could have, if he'd have got back, I think he would have risen to be head of the High Seas Fleet. And I think he would have done a damn good job at it.
He would have won the Battle of Jutland, because we all know Germany didn't win the Battle of Jutland. We know they told everyone they did, Chris. Yeah,
but they didn't.
But they didn't lose either. But that's a fight for another day.
Just a final one on von Spee and his squadron. Were they on a hiding to nothing? And were there fundamental flaws with Kreuzkrieg?
I think basically the German government knew that all the cruisers that were on foreign station were write-offs. And it was basically try and do as much damage as you can. I mean, they're kind of reliant on, they need coal, so they have to get as much coal as possible. Their ammunition is always going to be finite because you can only get that from Austro-Hungarian bases or German bases. And Tsingtau was quickly blockaded and eventually captured. There's some great stories from that, from other part, remnants of the squadron, the destroyer S-90 and the air arm. But the cruisers also, as well, if you get damaged, you can't really get repair. If you go to a neutral port, you can make your ship seaworthy, but you can't do anything to improve the war status of the ship. So if you get in a battle and you get really damaged, you're going to have to intern. And but most of the squadron get caught and roundly sunk. Emden gets sunk at the Battle of the Cocos. They get massacred by the Australian Sydney. My friend who works at the IWM with me actually used to work, when she went abroad, was at the Australian War Memorial, and she said they will not shut up about the Emden, because that was the Australian Navy's. Yeah, that was
that's like
that was
the first victory of the Australian Navy, isn't it?
Yeah, they had they. I mean, to be fair to Emden, they were caught with their pants down. The fourth funnel didn't work on that occasion. And an SOS call went out and they were caught without steam. And the Sydney just took them apart. Yeah. And
they had done enough damage that it was going to happen. If the Emden got caught, they knew they were done.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The other ships, Karlsruhe off the north coast of America, doesn't get mentioned very much, but she had a very good career as well. She blows up for no apparent, they're not quite sure what caused it. It might have been an ammunition problem. She was sailing to the Caribbean, and then the Königsberg off Africa ends up building a fortress in a river and daring the British to come and get them. And they takes them months to get her out.
Yeah.
But the von Spee squadron, Fisher just didn't want them there anymore. It's like, we're just going to eliminate this threat completely. And like I said, Churchill had organized pieces around von Spee wasn't going to get away. And even the Dresden, which did escape the Battle of the Falklands, had a whole fleet searching for her for about 3 months. They tried hiding in off Tierra del Fuego, off the south coast of America, where Pagels then turns up and starts guiding them around. They're actually hidden on British maps, the position that they're on. British maps count it as on land. And so they keep cruising past this isolated bay in the middle of nowhere where Dresden is hiding. Dresden finally escapes, but they have to use their wireless to try and signal for supply ships because they're desperate. They're actually using wood to try and burn in the boilers. And HMS Kent and Glasgow turn up. And at Robinson Crusoe Island, what's left of the Dresden, because she's in quite a bad way at this point, is sunk. And the German crew all have to abandon ship, which is where Tirpitz the pig is then fished from the ocean, from the sea, and given the Iron Cross by the crew of HMS Glasgow, and she becomes the mascot.
Oh, Tirpitz the pig, we love. Yeah, the head is at IWM. See, it wasn't that hard, was it?
Absolutely brilliant.
No.
It's all like, oh no, it's like, you don't need to prep, you're obsessed with this stuff.
You know it.
And you even got Tirpitz the pig in, which means that everybody's happy.
Yeah, can't have that story without Tirpitz the pig. Oh, and Admiral Canaris, who everyone that's interested in World War II, Admiral Canaris, head of the Abwehr, the German intelligence, who was leading, was part of the plot to kill Hitler, had been a watch officer on Dresden, and he goes aboard HMS Glasgow to parley the surrender of Dresden. And then after the Dresden sinking, the first officer had his leg blown off, so he goes to hospital. Captain Ludek has a nervous breakdown, so Canaris becomes in charge of the crew. And he actually escapes from Chile over the border into Argentina, gets a boat to Holland, and then from Holland walks back to Germany because he can speak three languages. And he as well was quite a badass through the whole thing.
Sounds like it. We will have to do a podcast episode on him as well. Chris, tell everyone the title of your book about the German cruiser squadron.
It is German Raiders of the First World War, Kaiserreich Marine Cruisers and the Epic Chases.
We will put it on the History Hack bookshop so everybody can buy it.
Get it. Yeah.
And I can retire.
Or buy Sophie presents.
Yeah. Oh, she's soundly asleep. Well, she's put something over her eyes. Yeah, she's grunting. She's asleep.
Well, the rest of us are still awake, and we thought you were awesome.
Thanks.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org. where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.